Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Peter Bukvar and Ira Harris. Peter is the Chief Investment Officer for the Bleakley Financial Group and Advisory, and he has a newsletter product called The Book Report, bookreport.com, BOOKREPORT.com. It offers great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. Ira's hedge fund manager, global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He has served as CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Richard.
Hey,
it's a pleasure
Thanks
to
have you
here. In fact, I know people are waiting for this, so when I told them, they're very excited because Peter made a big splash with the Rosenberg RIA. Is that right?
Real Vision.
Yeah. A lot of people watch that. So
great.
Let's see if we
can. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Let's begin with a discussion on just the big picture view, like the global economy and the view on the financial markets. Peter?
So I think we're reaching an important potential inflection point with this whole inflation story. And when you look back, at least over the last 10 plus years since central bankers went into a new mode of accommodation to deal with the housing crisis, what allowed them to perpetuate that even when we got past the housing crisis was a low level of inflation. So consider low inflation sort of being a driver's license for a central banker on a road where there's no speed limits. And now I think we have central banks, particularly the Fed, the ECB, the BOJ, where others are slowing down, like the Bank of Canada, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, that says they're ending QE. But those others, including the Fed, are driving, I think, 200 miles an hour in 55, thinking that they still have that sort of get out of jail free card of low inflation. And that's why this inflation discussion is so important, because if these price pressures, both at the wholesale level and now consumer level, remain persistent, then central bankers and the Fed may get pulled over, so to speak, or at least they're going to have to start slowing down the pace of their driving, because that road gets icier with every monthly increase of aggressiveness in these inflation stats. And, you know, you look at CPI yesterday, core CPI, it wasn't just a tenth or two tenths higher than expected. It was more than double what was expected. I mean, to expect four tenths and to see a print of nine tenths, to see core PPI today, it's estimated to be up 0.5% and a print 1%. These are aggressive price increases, and I referred in my note yesterday, this is called price instability. And it will dictate the pace at which central bankers respond. So when we have a crisis, we know central bankers go whole hog, but only after the crisis is already here. They never obviously foresee one ahead of time. Obviously, many of us did not see the pandemic, but at least the housing crisis, they certainly didn't foresee, even though they're the ones that created the basis for it. But when it comes to reversing, they have their plan and they take their time and adhere by that plan. Greenspan in the 2000s raised rates at a quote unquote measured pace. We know that Yellen took Bernanke and Yellen 7 years of zero interest rates before they raised interest rates. So we know they go slow. But that was at their own pace, at their own volition. If we have inflation that is persistent, well, then that timeline of their choosing gets taken away. So that's why I think, okay, we've had 4 months of hot CPI numbers. I think if you get a couple more, then you're going to get possibly a repeat of the first quarter where the bond market starts to price in or adjust interest rates to where they think they should be based on the rate of inflation, irrespective of any timeline the Fed wants to be on. You know, the Fed is they're always winging it. But Powell's testimony today is proving that they're winging it even more. They can't define what substantial progress is. They can't define a period of time of inflation moderately above their 2% or how long that will be. They can't define transitory. So they're just winging it. But the pressure is now building on them. We've seen a lot of questions in this testimony, people asking about inflation, asking about these aggressive housing price increases. Now, obviously, he danced around all the questions, but the questions are coming. The focus is now growing. The inequality fingers are being pointed at them. There was an editorial in the New York Times yesterday about that. So to quickly sum up, the answer to this inflation story is going to dictate, obviously, where rates go, but what the Fed's response function is, and certainly where the level of global interest rates are being so low, there's really no cushion to handle any sustainable rise in inflation. And certainly equity multiples that are literally through the roof, there's no margin for error if inflation remains sticky here.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Agree across the board. There's some other issues that I would raise. And you know what? I go back to, you know, we've done three or four of these, Peter and I, over the last year. But the issue was raised, I think, last year ago, May, June. What would happen? And I asked this question, I asked it a lot of places. What would happen if unemployment was at 9% and headline inflation was 6%? Would the Fed raise rates? And of course, it was there was unanimity in no. And then, you know, the unemployment rate dropped far faster than I thought. So now we are at 5.9. And headline, what number should we use, Peter, for headline inflation by their measure?
You mean at the current run rate?
Yeah.
Well, the last 4 months, core CPI is running at an annualized rate of 8.4%.
Okay.
Even if you cut that in half, it's still double their target.
Wow. Right. So here we are, and there are no. And as Peter says, they have no plan to raise rates. And it's interesting. So we have Powell today, who appears before Congress under a scheduled Humphrey. Well, it's no longer called a Humphrey Hawkins testimony, but it does derive from that. And every time he shows up to Congress, he's more dovish by far. Let's use the statistician's number by a factor of 3 or 4. He's so dovish, and it's all about jobs. And again, I take the Fed at their word. So when they tell me over and over and over again, including the Secretary of Treasury, that the real unemployment rate, okay, let's say we back off from 10%, but we're at 9%. So do they, and it's unbelievable that nobody at these press conferences asked the Fed, well, if inflation gets to 8%, 9%, and unemployment is still at 9%, will you raise rates? I mean, it's a fairly simple, straightforward question. If unemployment is, you know, by your definition, I didn't lay out that definition. They said that the real rate is not, well, last we heard was 10%, but it's dropped a little bit from there. So let's be kind and say 9%. I didn't use that. The Fed uses that. So why isn't that a genuine question to ask them? So if that's the case, then you're certainly more, and he says it over and over again, because he talks about minority hiring and wages is still not close. So that must mean that they're going to sustain this regardless. Why are we doing this dance? And why do the Wall Street economists, I'm not putting Peter in that camp, continue to play the game? If it's unemployment that really needs that we're not going to move, then say it. Now we have genuine forward guidance and we'll know what to do. But of course, that would necessitate interest rates going higher. And then they would force, you know, to do yield curve control. Because believe me, the interest rates wouldn't just go higher on the short end. You would go and attack the most vulnerable, which, of course, would be probably 7 years and out to drive those rates, which we saw happen right up until March, April of this year, we saw a sustained rise in rates. And now we back off because there is a sense that maybe the Fed is going to curtail QE, even though I believe this, and I'll state this unequivocally. The Fed will be the last to move. Now, as Peter talked about, we had New Zealand announced quantitative easing last night, the end of quantitative easing. We had the Bank of Canada cut from $3 billion down to $2 billion. Jakey just came in the room, so we're going to have a little background noise. I believe the Fed will be the last, and I believe the Fed will be the last for a definitive reason. They want the dollar lower because they want inflation higher, and they want to protect. If inflation goes higher, they'll try to protect against unemployment rising through thinking that they're going to gain some export sector. Well, you know, I'm just not sure about that. And I don't see it that way at all. I think nothing would make them happier than if the dollar actually went lower. And it would, because first of all, there's so much overhang of debt, dollar denominated debt around the world. I just don't see any other way around it. So that's all part and parcel of this, which is why I unequivocally believe that the Fed will be the last to move on what Peter framed back in 2018 as quantitative tightening. So that'll be something to watch. I'll stop there.
Mm-hmm. And Peter, what would be your view then on the yield curve for U.S. interest rates, a necessarily rise as steepening, or what are your thoughts there, and the effects on equities and commodities thereof?
Well, it's interesting with the yield curve. When you look back since QE1, every time QE was on full strength, the yield curve actually steepened. Now, we know in the Fed's models that wasn't what they intended. Their intention was to lower long-term interest rates via their purchases. But the exact opposite happened. When QE turned off through the tapering, the yield curve flattens because people anticipated, let me get back. The yield curve steepened on QE because people priced in reflation and an improving economy. When QE came off, people started to price in a slowdown in the economy, and then they flattened curve. So what we saw in the middle of June, when we saw a couple of people or more people that wanted to raise rates in September, and the Fed finally discussing the possibility of tapering, the flattening of the curve was just the exact knee-jerk trade that has worked through QE1, QE2, QE3, and the Fed eventually raising interest rates. So I think what we're going to have now from here on out, because this flattening obviously came after the steepening the first 3 months of the year on the rising inflation that we're now seeing and the rising inflation expectations embedded in the TIPS market. So now going forward, it's going to be this tug of war between some days you'll have the steepening because people are worried about the inflation. And then other days, people thinking, okay, well, the Fed's going to eventually respond to that inflation and start the tapering. Therefore, let's flatten it. I will say, though, that I think we can be assured, and Powell is doing so again today, that they are going to drag their feet kicking and screaming before they do anything, and that this inflation story is going to run so far ahead of them that then that means that, okay, I think eventually the bond market will repeat the first quarter of this year, and we'll see a re-steepening again, because the bond market doesn't want to hear, oh, let's run things hot. They want, if you're a bondholder, you actually want to hear about a more hawkish Fed, because that would keep any uncontrolled rise in rates from happening. So you get a couple of more months of high inflation rates. And I'm not talking, we don't need to repeat this week where you saw 9/10 at the core rate. Even if you get 4 or 5/10, that's a serious problem. Even if that 8.4% annualized rate over the last 4 months slows to even 3 or 4, that's a serious problem. And when you look at core CPI from June 2021, from June 2019, we're running at a 3% annualized rate. Now, if the Fed funds rate was 2.5, 3, 3.5, and the 10-year was 4 to 5%, okay, I'd say, okay, you know, we can handle 3% inflation. But when the Fed funds rate is at zero, when the 10 years at 136 and the Fed is doing massive QE, even a 3% inflation rate is not a good backdrop for that. So I know we started talking all about the Fed here, but I think the point is that this inflation story should not be taken so nonchalantly by a lot of market players, that in the post-Greenspan era of doing whatever they want, that begins to get altered by an inflationary situation that is turning into a potentially stagflationary situation that we're seeing in autos and housing and other parts of the economy, because it essentially is kryptonite on central bank policy. And that's why this is so crucial in trying to figure out what the world is going to look like, not just the next 6 months, but at least through the next year.
Interesting. Your thoughts, Ira?
Yeah, so let me pick up, because Peter goes down to what I think is the absolute right path. We look at the yield curve, and after the June 16th meeting, we did see an interesting outcome to that, which is what happened when there was talk of tightening. The 30-year actually rallied, meaning the yield fell, but the 5-year yield dropped. I'm sorry, rose. I have to think in terms of cash price, in terms of yield, rose about 30 basis points. So that curve flattened dramatically. I think we had like a 45 point move very quickly. And with that, as the curve flattened, then, the Fed's hawkish, the Fed's hawkish, the Fed's hawkish. For the life of me, listening to the press conference, I couldn't see it. And the fact that they didn't move at all on quantitative easing, and they left it at $120 billion, I couldn't see the hawkishness at all. What, 2 rate raises 2 years out? Sorry. Even as Powell was telling them that their forecasting stinks, and I'm being kind. So we saw all of that, and people were going, the reflation trade is over. And I said, reflation trade is not over. What you're seeing is that those who were over-leveraged in following that trade are being washed out, and you saw some hedge funds suffered major losses in June because they were liquidating. And as much as I hate that commitment of traders report, they did reflect how much was taken off in copper, gold, silver, some grains, although the grains became very interesting because they got down to levels, even though they were 3.5, like let's take the soybeans because it's such a nice barometer of what's going on in the world. The soybeans had been $3.50 off their highs. But again, everybody wants to measure off their highs, but it came down to a very nice support level. And we are well above where they were on June 16th. So as I look at this board, again, the grains are trying to tell an important message here. It's not about reflation, non-reflation. Prices are rising around the globe. Food prices are rising. We have wheat prices back up, but we have soybean prices. From the looks of it, I will tell you, fully expect $20 soybeans this year. That's not a forecast. I'm just watching the way the market is reacting. And I like watching the grains for this reason. And make no mistake about what I'm going to say here. There is no shortage. There is no supply shortage in the grain markets. We've run record crops for the last 2.5-3 years. So the bins have been full, but yet prices have rallied. And that has told me a lot. It's told me a lot about China, because I believe that China has been stockpiling everything from iron ore to copper. And they've been using a strengthening yuan to make that so. And I think that is a very, very important barometer of what's going on in the world. And you know what? There is no binary. It's not a Manichaean black and white. Is this reflation, non-reflation? No. And don't just look at over-leveraged positions as indicative of it. And everybody's trying to say, well, the Chinese are putting pressure. You know what? The Chinese have stockpiled massive amount of raw materials. They're making a lot of money. Look what happened last week. What day is today? Last Wednesday. They auctioned off, or last Monday, they auctioned off 15,000 tons of copper from their stockpiles that certain people argued didn't, there were no stockpiles. How do you know that? They auctioned off aluminum, and they were doing it out of stockpiles to Chinese fabricators and manufacturers, by the way. So they were able to buy from the Chinese stockpiles at lower prices than most of the people in the market, which I find interesting, which then benefits the Chinese more. So don't look at this merely as a reflation. And I still see the yuan sitting pretty nicely at 647. So we've seen no movement. And John Authors wrote a piece yesterday, and I think he's got it backwards, because in the piece he talked about that the Chinese were concerned because producer prices in China were going up, which meant higher export prices, while consumer inflation was dropping, which meant lower demand. And I think he's got it totally backwards, by the way. I think that's a narrative that is, as I've maintained for a long time, that is usually played out, which when the Chinese were looking to export, they were worried about, you know, their prices on the global situation. Now it's not as important to them as the domestic inflation. And domestic inflation is absolutely under control. And I would argue a lot of that is because the Chinese have been stockpiling prior to the takeoff in the global economy, structured with a stronger yuan. And I expect the yuan to go higher, not lower. I certainly expect it to challenge at 625. So, but coming back to that yield curve, this yield curve is going to tell us a lot. And I believe that Peter is going to be proven right. And then the curve will steepen. But that's what we want to see, because that's going to really test the Fed if the curve steepens. If the curve doesn't steepen, that just means that people are moving to sell the belly, because I still maintain that the five-year note is probably the most overvalued asset, maybe in the world. Although I could argue about the bobble and the the bobble and the, what's the word I'm looking for? Help me. The bobble. That's the German 5 year. I'm just trying to get my wits. We've seen that. So, and then those may be more over it, but the 5 year U.S. 5 years. And that's why it was such an easy sell, because if you think the Fed is going to raise rates, I think Peter has shown this in his work, the effective 5 year yield is probably a negative 160 basis points or so. Well, that's ridiculous, but that's all because of the Fed breaking the markets. And they're not the only ones. We heard from Lagarde earlier this week, and we've heard from the Japanese. And they're all in the same path. I would say I'd fail them all, because I believe that they plagiarize off each other's papers if they were in school, because it's every statement is the same statement. Although now we got a little differentiation with the Canadians and the New Zealanders. So we'll see how this really continues to play out. I'll stop.
And Peter, what are your thoughts on China in terms of their monetary and fiscal policies, strengthening currency, also the activities of stockpiling of commodities? How do you see that all playing in on the current environment for financial markets?
Well, I agree with Ira that this commodity bull market still has legs to it, and China still remains a big factor in that. I think people look at copper and they say, well, China's not going to be building as many as apartments, so how can there be demand for copper? But what we've seen is there's already new demands for copper in other different industries. I think people also don't really appreciate the lack of investment, at least on the industrial metal and the energy side, that we've seen and we're in the midst of. To Ira's point on ag, yeah, there's an enormous amount of demand for food, and that is going to lead to rising crop prices. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw $20 a bushel for soybeans as well, and I wouldn't be surprised if it got back to $8 corn also. Now, whether it stays there or not, we'll have to see, but I do think we'll be getting there. And I think in the context of this, China doesn't mind. China, the only thing China doesn't like is disorderly moves in their currency. They like the strong currency relative to the dollar, because it does sort of give them some optical strength, but also they want to shift to more consumer spending, where a stronger currency would be a help to that. Their crackdown on commodities reminds me of the wage and price controls that we saw in the 1970s. Now, maybe it works initially, but then it always ends up failing. But I think if they can keep a strong currency, it'll help mitigate a lot of those type inflation pressures. Now, with respect to consumer prices, we still have to remember that through Asia, you know, they're not vaccinated like we are, and there's a lot of reopenings happening in fits and starts. So it's not the same sort of aggressive pricing power that businesses have to pass on to the consumer. Also, you know, housing is a big component to U.S. inflation stats. While China has inflation in terms of home prices, that's not necessarily captured in that CPI number. So I think, but we're seeing this around the world. Wholesale prices that are skyrocketing is a global phenomenon, and each country has its own dynamic, and businesses have their own dynamic in how much they can pass that on to consumers.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
No, that's absolutely right. And the spillover effect, you see how it's all globally coordinated. It's 100% in sync. Somebody will break out of this. Maybe New Zealand started something, you know, because don't forget the 2% inflation target came out of New Zealand. Everybody will forget that under Don Brash when he was head of the governor of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. It's all so coordinated, except that probably one of the best investments has been Chinese bonds, right? Denominated in yuan, by the way, just like other bonds that have had, you know, some nice moves, or Mexican bonds. I'll tell you what, one of the best investments over the last 5-6 years you could have made was buying Israeli bonds in shekels. I mean, these have performed really well. Now, people, you know, we're seeing the bond rally again in the U.S. And everybody's trying to explain it. But I don't know that you can explain it, because we, again, it's a double-edged sword. We don't know what the Fed is really doing. And to say that, that's why I would like to see the long end of the curve get hit and yields rise dramatically, because it would call the question on whether the Fed really intends to do yield curve control, mimicking other central banks, or whether how far are they willing to let those yields rise. That becomes a very good test. And I think it's critically important. The short end, they're not going to move, but I think the Fed has set the pattern for everybody. Because again, going back to Powell's the double shotgun approach, according to Druckenmiller, and what Peter banged the drum hard on in 2018 about the quantitative tightening while raising rates, you hear it from all the central banks. You'll see quantitative tightening, like you saw with New Zealand last night, but no discussion at all about raising rates. In fact, they bend over backwards to say they'll be slower to raise rates. And I think that's all due to the Powell mistake and others. You know, like when he's dovish, everybody thinks he's positioned himself to be reappointed, because don't forget his term's up January of 2022. But I'm willing to bet, make a large bet, that Powell will not be reappointed either way. I think that seat has been reserved for Lael Brainard. It'll be done under having a greater diversity, whatever else you want to. Not that she's not capable. I'm not making that case one iota. But everybody, you know, the media wants, Powell will be. I don't think he'll be reappointed regardless. I think he needs somebody more friendly. And I think Lael Brainard is on record multiple times talking about the importance of yield curve control. And especially as the deficit grows and grows and grows and has to be funded with ever lower rates. So that all plays out. And I think the Chinese and others are watching this very carefully. I mean, you've heard it from the Russians, right? Not that the Russians are what I would call a class A player. I would put them in as a class B, but they've moved out of dollar assets, the Russian sovereign wealth fund. And you have to applaud that because, again, as Peter talks about, rising commodity prices, the Chinese are buying them not just for utility value, but again, why wouldn't you diversify yourself into a harder asset class away from dollar assets? That makes good investment sense. So I would keep doing it, and you can build and you can stockpile these. You know, it's we talk about that the Singapore government built a 15,000 ton silver warehouse at the Singapore airport. So a lot of ways to divest yourself from dollars. And some of it is not going to be very beneficial to the U.S. and other developed nations. So they'll want their currencies rising in order to stem the higher oil, although oil is getting hit today probably because of supposedly there's discussion about United Arab Emirates and Saudi deal out of OPEC. So I think that's what's hitting the oil. But a lot more to go here. That's all I'm going to say. It's not as easy as people want to believe.
And Peter, do you see the potential for a emerging liquidity crisis in the financial system, given the volatility recently in the reverse repo market, reverse repurchase agreement market?
I'm actually not that worried about that. I think it's a symptom of markets that are broken. It's a symptom of a Fed that has way overdone it with their purchases. I mean, just think of the irony of what's going on. Fed is continuing to buy every month assets in QE, and then they basically just give back those assets in these repo facilities. I'm like, what's the point? It's nonsensical. So while it these numbers are large every day, you know, almost $1 trillion of the overnight usage, I think it's just more of a symptom of a broader problem and not necessarily a problem of itself, because, you know, the Fed can handle all these overnight repos. So it's just something, it's broken, the system is broken, but I don't necessarily can't draw a line yet to it being a problem.
Mm-hmm. And
I mean, the broader problem is when the Fed starts to, you know, yeah, step back from their, you know, QE and eventually raise rates at some point.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, everything Peter said, I agree with. And I would raise one more issue that I think needs to be discussed to call the Fed out on this. Because as Peter said, you know, why bother to do this? This is you raise reverse repo rates. You raise interest on excess reserves, right? All to prevent headline rates or T-bill rates, especially going negative for an extended period of time. It's all part and parcel of it. But I raise this question to the Fed. There is the issue that still exists out there on what is called the narrow bank. The narrow bank was an attempt to establish a bank for large institutional depositors to deposit overnight money into what was called the narrow bank. And the narrow bank, being that it was a member of the Federal Reserve, would take those funds and put them into the interest on excess reserves. That way they could shave a little, but here, right now the interest on excess reserves is 15 basis points. So if I'm an institution and I have overnight funds and I'll deposit it at the narrow bank, which doesn't exist yet, by the way, I could take a 5 basis point cut and say, okay, I've got 200, 300, 400, 500 billion in funds. I think Peter and I could live on that 5 basis points pretty well for a year. I don't need much more than that, I promise. On those kind of numbers, and you're in the safest institution of all, the Federal Reserve, and you're earning at least 10 basis points, far more than you're getting elsewhere. But the Fed has blocked this. And this was put together by a person who came out of the New York Fed, because it makes perfect sense. But yet, and it is a question, that somebody should ask, why doesn't the Fed allow the narrow bank to get a banking license to be a member of the Federal Reserve? And they're telling you that's all they want to do. So that would be the first question I would ask Powell. Why are you so opposed to this that you've gone to such extremes to block it? And that plays to what Peter talked about with the overnight funding issue.
And Peter, given this environment in the economy and the financial markets we've just discussed, what trading opportunities or investments generically do you like currently?
So I remain long energy stocks, ag stocks, particularly fertilizers, like uranium. Still very bullish and long gold and silver. And to me, there's some selective value stocks that I like in the U.S., but most of my focus has been more internationally. I find markets in parts of Europe and in Asia a lot more attractive than the U.S. On the fixed income side, because I'm bearish on the dollar, I think the only place that you can find yield is in emerging market non-dollar or local currency bonds. So I think that there's some opportunity there to clip some decent coupons where it's almost impossible to find that anywhere else. But, you know, I'm just a natural worrywart. And, I just keep looking at these inflation stats. And, I listen to a lot of company conference calls because I think it's important to sort of hear from the horse's mouth, so to speak, on what they have to say about pricing. And I just don't see this just being so temporary. I mean, I'm seeing companies that are not just raising prices once to absorb some price increases. They're doing it two times. They're doing it three times because they're overwhelmed with the cost pressures. And this is before really that we're seeing more of an acceleration in wage costs. Like, to me, this is just the beginning of businesses being able to pass this on. And yeah, we're gonna see some moderation in, like we've seen in lumber prices, and I'm sure used car prices will come off. But for every person, I love it how people who think that this is temporary, they pick and choose. I've seen a lot of emails that they're picking and choosing and taking out certain inflation stats and saying, oh, well, if we take out all these things, then inflation is not that high. Well, for every used car pullback that you expect, I'll throw you rental home prices that are going to be skyrocketing over the next 6 to 12 months. For every lumber pullback you show me, I'll show you oil prices that are just below $75. So I don't like this picking and choosing and then rationalizing it. And keep in mind also, so we get a pullback in used car prices because people can't afford used cars anymore because the prices are so much. Well, maybe they shift to cheaper new cars, and maybe we get price increases on cheaper new cars. I think the bottom line is that people are missing by picking and choosing is that we have commodity price inflation, we have transportation cost inflation, we have other supply and product inflation, and now we have a reacceleration of services inflation. And services inflation is never temporary and never is in big cap letters. The only thing that has kept aggregate inflation moderate, relatively speaking, has been the goods side. So you don't need even very high goods prices to see 3% type inflation. All you have to see is goods prices rising above 1%, and you combine that with near 3% on average service price inflation for the 20 years going into COVID, and you'll have 3% plus inflation, I believe, for a more sustainable period of time. And keep in mind, the world's financial structure is predicated on low inflation, low being less than 2, with very low interest rates. You get a period of time of 3 to 4, and that will be well off the boil of 8, then that's still a problem. And one thing within this PPI number today is I like to look at, they sort of call it inflation in the pipeline, where you have the finished goods prices, but then you have categories below that, unprocessed goods and processed goods, before it gets to sort of finished goods. I mean, the month-over-month increases in processed goods prices are through the roof, ex food and energy. So there is still a lot that is flowing through this pipe. And if there's one thing that the Fed likes to talk about, is they're very big on inflation expectations driving policy. Well, you can be sure every month that goes by, these price increases get embedded in those expectations. And these aren't just, these are the most intense price pressures since the 1970s, early 1980s. I mean, in the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index, we saw a 40-year high in those small businesses that are looking to raise selling prices, a 40-year high. And the transitory camp just thinks, oh yeah, this will just go away, you know, couple months, couple quarters, it's just going to go away. And it's just not going to happen. Now, I'm a believer in that this just being more cyclical goods inflation. I mean, everything's transitory except services inflation, right? I mean, 1970s inflation ended up being transitory in the sense that the rate of change slowed, but inflation goes up every single year. So it's just the rate of change that we're discussing here. And just to get to my final point, the level of global interest rates and the extremity of monetary policy is totally unprepared and offside for any sustained level of inflation north of even, you know, of 3%, let alone 8%.
And which emerging markets in particular do you like the most?
Emerging Asia. Some emerging Asia, you can't even call them emerging anymore. I mean, Singapore is not an emerging market. It's as developed as any, but I think there are a lot of attractive stocks there. South Korea, Japan, Vietnam. Japan's obviously an emerging market, but I like Asia. On the emerging side, Vietnam, would be one of my favorites as well. Other parts of emerging markets, you know, I go back and forth on Brazil, but being bullish and not, South Africa doesn't interest me. Turkey will at some point interest me when Erdogan leaves, but that's not anytime soon. But Turkey will be really interesting when Erdogan leaves.
And Ira?
Basically, I believe it or not, I own some foreign banks that I've looked at. And I'm looking for some movements there. They've been so unloved. They're not doing anything. I'm living off the dividends at this point in time. We've got a little gain in some of them, but nothing much. I say I've gotten out of a bunch of, you know, on the highs of the initial rally, and I'm just waiting a little bit. I still own, I love Glencore. I think Glencore, whatever, always runs afoul of the ESG crowd and other political actors. But I do like the mining stock. I had Freeport, as Peter and I talked about again last year. It was a wonderful play. I am since out of that, waiting for an opportunity to reacquire. Kansas Southern was another really good play. I'm out of that. Because I got out way early relative to where I went to, but now they have to deal with the FTC, so I wouldn't even consider that at this moment. Energies are some. I like the natural gas still, and natural gas has been a very, very solid play. But, you know, I believe that equity prices, for the most part, very much like Peter, are very stretched here. I can't stand the U.S. debt markets because I just look at this and I go, the negative, it would force me to buy 30 years because at least 30 years are close to a break even to inflation. The rest of the curve is massively trading negative real yields, which is good for equities, but not good for longer term bonds unless you think that there's a deflation problem coming, but I don't see that. And a lot of that is because I look at China differently. I think Peter's right on some of the emerging market bonds, but be careful and cautious as the politics, as Peter points out, can be very difficult to deal with because when there's a political scare like right now in South Africa with what's going on there with demonstrations and the response to Zuma, and the way they're dealing with it, it does wreak some havoc for you. But actually, you know, when you look at the RAND on a relative basis compared to where it was last year, the RAND is substantially higher still, even though it's had a sell-off here in the face of Zuma, but I think that South Africa is a more interesting area for many reasons. And if they weather this short-term crisis, I think people will come pouring back in. Because again, there is no yield. And I leave people with this measure, okay? It's really pretty simple. Call your bank. If you have the funds and say, I'd like to buy a one-year U.S. Treasury bill for $1 million. Now, you buy that at a discount and it expires at par. So how much money do you think you're going to make? And that's a standard bearer, by the way. That's a one-year U.S. Treasury bill. Call and find out. And you'll be surprised to learn that you might make $500 for your $1 million.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't do a lot for anybody who has $1 million in assets. So what does the 500 do you? Nothing. And it forces you out, which is what, again, the Bernanke play was with the portfolio balance channel, into more riskier assets. This hasn't ended. And people are therefore forced down the risk curve. You must take more curves. I do buy some preferreds when they do come public, and you know what? I'll ride them for a little bit. I just did one, and I picked up about 13% return in 4 months, not including the interest, which was 5.25%. So overall, over five or six months, it's been a 16% yield, and now I'm out because all I'm going to do is see erosion. But because there's only so high that people will pay above its original offering price. But I look at those. I'm forced, like everybody else, to go scouring for things to invest in. And therefore, I try to find quality companies that I believe are value companies with great growth potential. And if my views on commodity assets across the board are right, then I find companies who I think are acting responsibly with low debt levels. You know, I'm also long the ABB, the Swiss-Swedish
consulting services. Yeah,
I'm long that too. Our ABB.
It's actually up at $36. So it's been such a wonderful play, especially over the last year. I mean, you can see it, and it pays a nice dividend. And they have growth potential because they're in the software development area for a lot of infrastructure.
Robotic business, electric charging stations they're building out, a lot of automation related. They were in very attractive end markets.
And you know what, Peter, I know we've talked about this. So this is another one over the year that has worked well. If we go back to May, a year ago, May, it was trading, you know, $19.50. It's up at 36. Yep. But it also paid a very nice dividend through all that time period. And if Europe does what I believe it's going to do with massive infrastructure into the green area, this is one firm that could, you know, it's a big firm and it takes a lot to move the needle, but it's a quality firm.
I agree.
I used to look at Fleur, but Fleur is probably the worst managed company that I've seen, because where they should be excelling here, they've been struggling for quite a long time here, and I am so glad I got off of them in the mid to high 20s and stayed away. I just don't understand. Even before the onset of COVID, they were because of stuff that went on in Puerto Rico, they've been you want to see the effects of bad management on a company, take a look at that. Those are things that I'm looking at. I think things that are quality firms with upside. U.S. banks, I think, are pretty much full valued, although I can get the dividend in the preferred realm rather than playing in the common. And J.P. Morgan was a good play for me, as well as others. I still like AllianceBernstein as a buyout because they've been such a huge aggregator of funds that I expect somebody to come and take over them when they see any type of opportunity. Although the way they're held is a joke. I think the stock, it was like Blackstone, which was not BlackRock, but Blackstone, which was held in a similar way. And then when they changed their structure from a partnership, so you can say getting K-1s, the stock exploded. I would expect AllianceBernstein to finally make that move too, but I've been waiting a long time for it. So I guess it's like Christmas, it'll eventually come. We'll bear any fruits, but that's about all I'm looking at. I really don't like the bond markets, and I know everybody's talking again. Peter talked about with Peter Rosenberg a few weeks ago. I just don't see it because I always believe, as much as I'm an Austrian and believe that debt overhangs are very important, I believe that the way the central banks are going to react to them, especially as Peter started the whole conversation out, it's a zero lower bound. What do they have left? And that's what keeps me from being from any sense of a long-term bond investor, because what do they have left? What is in their toolbox? I believe their toolbox is empty, and whatever they pull out is going to be fraught with great danger for the entire system, especially when the most irresponsible is the United States, which because of its role as a reserve, the world's reserve currency, will really set things on fire. We are not Japan in no way, shape, or form.
Awesome. Great insight. It's been a great insightful discussion. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Peter?
If they want to read my daily commentary, they can subscribe to the book report, as you said earlier, bookreport.com. And if they're interested in anything wealth management related, they can reach out to us through bleakley.com's website.
Great. And Ira?
You can find me doing a lot of Financial Repression Authority work. I haven't been writing again as much. I've been trying because I give Peter a lot of credit because every day is the same day. Every day you're just having to craft through what this Fed speaker said, this Fed speaker said. So it's all the same. It's every day is Groundhog Day. You feel like Bill Murray. So Peter covers the data so well, and that gives him something always. It's not what my strength is. I'm looking more at the global macro, and it's every day's a redo. Will that last for much longer? I don't think so. I think there are a lot of things afoot out there, and we'll be looking at them. But right now, it's a redo. You look at the bond markets, they wash back and forth, But so I will be writing, but most of the time we can cover a lot of this ground through these podcasts. So people should really avail themselves with what's out there. And I relish the great opportunity to do this with Peter. I think we cover, and last year, if you would have followed, I think Peter and I and with Louis Gavet, I think there was some really great work done at the Financial Repression Authority.
Great. Thank you so much, Peter and Ira.
Thank you both, guys. Always a pleasure.
Great. Thanks.
We'll send you the link when it's ready.
Richard, thanks so much. Ira, great to chat with you.
Yeah, Peter, maybe I'll give you I'm hanging around out here until Sunday anyway, and then heading back to Arizona, where it's been doing nothing but raining, by the way. And raining.
I heard. Very unusual for summer.
You know what? Yeah, they got, it is monsoon time, but they got over like an inch, 2 inches in Scottsdale the other day, and it's been raining. So it needs it badly, but.
Yeah, it's good to see.
That's a lot of water.
Yeah, I'm sure. But I think that whole area of the West needs some water.
Yeah. Be great, greatly.
Well, enjoy the grandkids.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
All the best.
Thanks again, Richard, for having us.
Yeah, thanks,
Richard.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
All right, take care, guys.